We've seen that the if say you were born in the family of Vedic ritualists, which means you are either you're one of the upper three classes. You're a Vaishya, a Kshatriya, or a Brahmin. You're a farmer or a trader, a Kshatriya warrior, or a royalty, or you're a Brahmin. You're a priest or a teacher. That's the family you're born into. Then you have the you're born with three debts that you have to pay off by the time you die. And the three debts, if you remember, are the first, you have the debt to the sages who have given you the Veda, the sacred knowledge. Secondly, you're indebted to your ancestors who... in whose family you're born, who've given you life, who've given you the family sort of tradition and culture of Vedic learning in which you're born. And the third debt you have is to the devas or the gods who provide you with the necessities of life and allow you to live a good life in this world. And so, as we talked about, in order to live a proper life, you have to repay these by the end of your life. And so the sages you repay by the study of the Veda. And so when you're still a child, you start what is called the... you become a brahmachari. Student who lives for an extended period of time with the guru, with the teacher, and from the guru learns the Veda, memorizes the Veda, learns to repeat the Veda after the guru, so that after, traditionally said, after 12 years, you've memorized the entire Veda that your guru belongs to. Your guru can be your father, often is your father, but it can also be someone else, in which case, during that period, you actually live in the family of the guru rather than with your own parents. And this is a life, as we've seen, in which you you focus on the Vedic study as well as tapas. And tapas is austerity, but is also the power that is generated by the austerity. So you live a simple life, you live an austere life. Prominent part of that life of tapas of austerity is total celibacy. You have no contact with women apart from the wife of the guru, whom you regard as your own mother. You live a very simple life in general. You sleep on the floor. You eat simple food. You do not shave. You do not bathe as normal people do, and so on. And you do this in order to generate this power, this tapas, this sort of ardor, this vigor that is this heat, literally, that is born within the body, which will prepare you then for the next stage of your life, which is when you become a householder, you set up your own family, and you have generated that power that allows you to then according to Vedic texts, primarily manifests itself in children that you will produce afterwards. It leads to fertility and so on. But also, a link to that is also the notion that this helps to focus the mind and harness the energies of the mind and focus it on Vedic study so that you're able to focus on the memorization of the Vedas. Now, after you've completed your study of the Veda, you graduate, you leave the family of the guru, you leave, even if that's your own father, you set up your own household. If you lived with someone else, you leave that person, and you get married, and you set up your own household. Now, when that happens, you become what is known as a grihastha, literally one who stays in a home, in a house, so a householder. And when that happens, one of the first things you do is when you set up your own household is you install Agni, you install the god of fire into your household, into your life. which is a ritual that you perform where you kindle fire and you invoke Agni, the god of fire, to be present in that, and you retain that fire until the end of your life. And it is from that fire that you will kindle every fire that you will use for the performance of Vedic ritual. So whenever you perform a Vedic ritual, which involves a kindling of fire and making offerings into fire, you will do that with the same Agni, with the same fire that is established at the beginning of your household. And so you have to keep that fire burning for your entire life. Now, the way you keep the fire burning is it's kind of generally kept in a clay pot, and it's kind of like charcoal and embers that are kept sort of smoldering in there. And you scoop some of that out and you use that to kindle more fire. But you have to add occasionally wood to it to keep that burning, which is why one of the chief sort of services that the brahmachari offers the guru is the collecting of firewood. And you find often in these texts that you should go with firewood in hand to the guru as sort of an offering of service to the guru so he can keep that fire burning. But once you are married, you have your own fire, you have your own Agni, and you continue performing Vedic rituals with that same fire. With that fire, of course, the main thing you do with that is you make offering to the gods, which means you repay this debt here, the third of the debts, by making sacrifices to the gods. You repay the debts to the gods, you repay them and give them the strength and the power to be gods and to maintain the order, the Ritta of the world. You have the other two debts that you have to do as well. The first one you have paid off by your life as a student. You repay the Vedas, you repay the sages by studying the Veda. But the second one, as we've seen, the ancestors you can only repay if you have children who continue the family lineage and continue to, continue the family line, but also continue to make offerings to the ancestors who are then in heaven. Now, when you die, when at the end of your life you've lived a good, pious life, you've had children who continue the family lineage, you've performed all the sacrifices, you've studied the Veda, but you've also maintained the study of the Veda in your householder life. As we all know, if you memorize something and you don't do anything with it, before you know it, it is lost. So they continue the private recitation of the Veda, where they continue reciting the Veda to themselves periodically. Generally, it's about a period of 40 days that they go through the entire Vedic text that they have memorized. And once you've done that, you've lived a good life, you die, and you're then cremated. And you're cremated with the fire that you established in your household. As it were, your entire life itself becomes an offering unto the gods, unto Agni, and Agni carries you to the world of the gods, where you will then reside in your own loka, in your own world. Or sort of your own sphere of influence that you have there among the gods. And so you find a lot of references in Vedic texts to the desire to obtain a world like that of Prajapati, the creator amongst the gods, or to obtain a world like that of one of the gods, or just a world in general, which basically refers to a place in heaven that you create for you by the performance of sacrifice. And as we've seen, Vedic ritualists see that this is a state of immortality. This is what the sort of the perfection of your life. Now, as we've seen last week, the Upanishads are Vedic texts in many ways. They're part of the Vedic canon. In the sense that they belong to Vedic texts and they're part of other Vedic texts. They also refer continuously to Vedic ritual ideas. They cite Vedic texts within them. But they're also all the teachers within the Upanishads, all the characters that occur are all Vedic ritualists themselves. So the Upanishads kind of build on this worldview. But as we've seen last week, there's sort of a big shift that takes place as well. And it's there that I want to start to sort of pick up that again to then move into the topic of what we'll look at today, which is asceticism and renunciation and ascetic movements that emerge. And if you look at the handouts, if you'll have one, if you're not, I think there's one or two more copies there. But if you look at the first passage you have there, this is from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is one of the longest and one of the most important Upanishads. And here, this is a conversation or a debate actually that takes place between a teacher called Yajnavalkya, who is himself a priest, and Gargi. And Gargi is a woman actually, and it's one of these sort of the puzzles in sort of the early history of the Vedic tradition. By the time of the Dharmashastras, the Dharmashastras are very clear that women are not allowed to study the Vedas and are not part of that whole sort of discourse of Vedic learning. But here in the Brihadaranyaka, you have this woman who comes forward and actually challenges Yajnavalkya in his understanding of things. But he's explaining some. She asked him a question to test his knowledge. And her question is a question that occurs in some Vedic texts as well, which is, what is the world woven onto? What holds the fabric of the world together? And as we've seen, the Upanishads say, the Vedas say, the world is woven onto sacrifice. Sacrifice holds the threads of this world together. But Yajnavalkya kind of ultimately says, well, it is what he calls the imperishable, which is Brahman, that holds the world together. And you have this passage here where he says, this is the imperishable guardian whose command the sun and the moon stand apart. This is the imperishable guardian whose command the earth and the sky stand apart. This is the imperishable guardian whose command seconds and hours, days and nights, fortnights and months, seasons and years stand apart. This is the imperishable guardian whose command rivers flow from the snowy mountains, the Himalayas, in their respective directions, some to the east and others to the west. This is the imperishable Gargi, at whose command people flatter donors, and gods are dependent on patrons of sacrifices, and forefathers on ancestral offerings. Without knowing this imperishable Gargi, even if a man were to make offerings, to offer sacrifices, and to perform austerities in this world for many thousands of years, all that would come to naught. Pitiful is the man, Gargi, who departs from this world without knowing this imperishable. But a man who departs from this world after he has come to know this imperishable, he, Gargi, is a Brahman. And so what we get here is what Yajnavalkya is saying, and the debate actually takes place at the performance of the sacrifice. And so it's kind of at the heart of the Vedic ritual culture, this debate takes place between Gargi and Yajnavalkya. What Yajnavalkya is saying in some sense echoes what the Vedic ritualists are saying, but he moves in a very different direction with this. And so what he's saying is that the order, that structure we see in this world is not the result of sacrifice that allows that sort of bigger order in the world as well as in society to be sustained, but is actually Brahman. It is beyond the power of sacrifice, is Brahman, and it is Brahman who keeps the earth and the moon apart, who keeps day and night and so on apart, who keeps everything moving as it is. And as he says, who is even the power behind the sacrifice, as he says there at the end of the first column, this is the imperishable at whose command people flatter donors, and gods are dependent on patrons of sacrifices and forefathers on ancestral offerings. And so the whole ritual culture, where the people who flatter donors are the Brahmins at the end of the sacrifice, they have to be paid, if you remember, for the sacrifice to be completed. And so they flatter the donors, the person who called for the sacrifice to be performed, the patron of the sacrifice, and say, oh, you're such a generous man, you're such a good man, so in the hope of receiving more. And so it is. And the gods are dependent on patrons of sacrifice. The patron of sacrifice is the person who calls the sacrifice to be performed, who hires the Brahmins to perform the sacrifice for him, and then at the end pays it. And the forefathers are dependent on ancestral offerings. So what Yajnavalkya is saying, the entire ritual culture, the entire ritual cycle that we have, this is actually not what is of ultimate importance, but because behind all this is the imperishable, which is Brahman. And as he says then, you know, if you don't know this, whatever you do, if a man were to make offerings, were to make sacrifices, and to perform austerities, and the austerities here is the tapas of the brahmachari, even if you were to do this for 1,000 years and you do not come to know the imperishable, then your life is a total waste. But he who knows this, he who knows this imperishable, he is a true Brahman, he's saying. In other words, all the Vedic ritualists who perform rituals, all those Brahmins who do not know Brahman are not actually true Brahmins. In order to be a proper Brahman, you have to rise to this knowledge. You have to come to understand this. You have to learn to look beyond the sacrifice. Which means then, of course, that if the ritualists look at the world and say, okay, the important thing is understanding the structure, the order within the world, responding in the appropriate way by acting in the appropriate way. And you act principally by performing sacrifices, but also acting the appropriate way by living according to your social class, by acting as a Brahmin, by acting as a Kshatriya, by acting as a Vaishya, and so on. What Yajnavalkya is saying, it is not about the action. What you do is irrelevant. You can do anything you want for 1,000 years, but if it is not done with the proper knowledge, with the proper understanding of what is the source of that order, then your life is, you live in vain. And so you see this sort of dramatic shift from the performance of actions, from the centrality of sacrifice, the centrality of making offerings to Agni, to the god of fire who carries the offerings to the gods, to the importance of Brahman, of the foundation of this world, of being itself, of, in some Upanishads, God as a sort of a theistic, the Upanishads that have a theistic perspective. And it is that sort of shift that really leads to what we'll be talking about today, to a radical new way of living and a new way of seeing the importance of everything that the ritualists are talking about. And we ended last class with some criticism that the Upanishads have of Vedic ritualists, where they argue they're ignorant, they're filled with desire, they're just pursuing their desire for enjoyment, which they hope they will attain by going to their loka, by going to their world in heaven. They think they're wise, they think they're learned because they have the sacred speech of the Vedas, but they're actually ignorant about their own self, of who they are. And so therefore, if we start inquiring about who we are and understand our relationship with Brahman, with the self of all, as we read in last week in another passage of the Brihadaranyaka, we are in a proper situation. And the passage we read at the end of last week is a very sort of dramatic sort of rejection of ritual. Most of the Upanishads are not like that. They're not so strong in this, and do see a place for Vedic ritual. And you have this other passage here that really encapsulates this wonderfully, also from the Brihadaranyaka, also from the teachings of Yajnavalkya, where he's talking about the nature of the self, and having talked, so having described the self, you get this passage then that you have there on the second part, the second passage on the handout, where he says, there in that space within the heart, he, the self, lies, the controller of all, the lord of all, the ruler of all. And here the self is particularly, the self is Atman, but as we've seen last week, the two terms are often used interchangeably in the Upanishads, because we as persons can only find our existence, can only understand who we are if we realize our relation or our identity in Brahman. And so here he's saying, so within that space in the heart, the self of all, the controller of all, the lord of all resides. He does not become more by good actions or in any way less by bad actions. This is the ritualist's concern. We become more by good actions, by performing good actions, particularly Vedic ritual action. We will become more because we will attain heaven and we will attain a stronger position there. If we perform bad actions, we will not obtain that and we will become less. And so here, but he's saying the self within the hearts of all, he does not become more by good actions or more by bad actions. He's unaffected by ritual. He's the Lord of all. He's the ruler of creatures. He's the guardian of creatures. He's the dike separating these worlds so they would not mingle with each other. Again, that notion of Ritta there. It is he that Brahmins seek to know by means of Vedic recitation, sacrifice, gift-giving, austerity, and fasting. It is he on knowing whom a man becomes a sage. It is when they desire him as their world that wandering ascetics undertake the ascetic life of wandering. It was when they knew this that men of old did not desire offspring, reasoning, ours is this self, and it is our world. What then is the use of offspring for us? So they gave up the desire for sons, the desire for wealth, and the desire for worlds, and undertook the mendicant life. The desire for sons, after all, is the same as the desire for wealth, and the desire for wealth is the same as the desire for worlds. Both are simply desires. What Yajnavalkya is teaching is that those who study the Veda and undergo the life of a brahmachari, those who perform sacrifices, do their Vedic recitation, their sacrifice, their gift-giving, the gift-giving to the Brahmins at the end of the sacrifice, perform their austerity, do their fasting, what they're really searching for, the immortality they hope to attain, is not to be found in the worlds of the gods, who are ultimately not immortal because even they will die, but is found only in that self. Their search for immortality is misguided and misdirected. They sort of hope to attain it there, but really it's something they have to unknowingly. They're searching for the self that lies within the space of the heart. And so it is their search for this that leads them to perform Vedic rituals. But it is once they come to know him, once they come to know Brahman, once they come to know the self, then Yajnavalkya says they give up this life. And they become a sage and they become mendicants. They leave society behind, they wander around and they beg for their livelihood. And the expression he uses here is quite important, where he says that what these ascetics have realized is they say, this self that is within our hearts, that is our world, that is our loka. The ritualists are trying to obtain a world in heaven, but we have found that world within us, that world of immortality lies within us. And therefore they say, why do we need children? Why should we have children who can help us to attain that world of heaven, that so-called state of immortality, and who can help us to remain there by continuing making offerings to us once we're one of their ancestors? Why would we need this when we have this world within us? And therefore they give up the desire for children, they give up the desire for worlds, the desire for heaven, and they give up the desire for wealth. The wealth, of course, that comes from the performance of Vedic sacrifice, both in the sense that the wealth you receive in charity at the end of the sacrifice if you're a Brahmin, but as well as the wealth that is said to the gods are showering you with when you perform Vedic rituals. And so they decide, we have nothing to do with this, we renounce this world, we will live by begging for food, and we will wander around and leave society behind. Because everything, all these things that the ritualists are about, are just desires. There's one Upanishad, the Maitri Upanishad, has this beautiful image where it says that desires are the people in this world, and particularly the ritualists, they're entrapped by their desires like a bird that is trapped within a net. And the more you try to move, and sort of the more the bird tries to move and make its way out of the net, the more it gets entangled within the desires. And so the only way to get out of it is to actually cut the desires, remove the desires, and not act upon those desires, and then you can escape the entanglement. And so the same you have here, what is the point of all these? These are just desires. These will entrap us within this and will make us think of everything that we are not, will make us think that we become more by good actions or less by bad actions and so on. What the Brihadaranyaka is proposing here is quite radical within the Vedic worldview, of course, because everything within for the Vedic traditions centers around the fulfillment of those three debts, the repayment of those three debts. Now, their first thing is they say, we don't want any children, which means this is gone. The second thing is they say, we do not want to obtain a world, which means also we do not want to perform sacrifice in order to attain a world. And so this is gone, which kind of retains a little bit of this, and as at least in the Upanishads, the ascetics are said to be versed in the Vedas and so on, but still they do not live a proper life, and according to Vedic ritualists, they are actually not destined for great things. And you have, indeed, you do find in early Vedic texts this criticism of this lifestyle that the Upanishads, at least some of the Upanishads, are prescribing. And I say some of the Upanishads because it's important to keep in mind that all the teachers in the Upanishads are actually married, and often they're teaching their sons about these things. And so it's kind of, there is a movement that emerges out of the Upanishads that stresses renunciation and that stresses the renouncing of the world. But you also have within the Upanishads a tradition that stresses you can stay within your family life and pursue that knowledge of Brahman within that context, and you do not have to give up the performance of Vedic rituals in order to do that, but it can assist you in doing that. Just as a sort of a caution there, do not conflate the two because they're quite different, but the ascetic movements take their inspiration from the Upanishads, find passages within those, and interpret them in those ways and use them as sort of encouragements for renunciation. But within early Vedic texts, you find refutations of those views and you find criticisms of those views. And you have this a passage here within the from the one of the Dharma Sutras, one of the earliest Dharma Shastra texts, those texts that talk about the what is dharma, how you should act in the world, in society. The Dharma Shastras in general, as we've seen, they exist within that ritual worldview. They embody, they sort of accept that ritual worldview, and whatever they say sort of flows from that understanding of the ritualist. And so the same thing is here, where you have, where it says there's only one order of life, the teachers maintain, because no offspring is produced in the others. And so the only order of life there is the householder order, the householder stage of life. That is the only proper stage of life, because only that leads to children. With respect to the above position, the critics of this, they cite this. These are not the critics. This is the teachers of old. They cite this. There was once a demon named Kapila, the son of Prahlada. It was he who created these divisions in his campaign against the gods. No wise man should pay any heed to him. To them. And so what the argument is here is that the demons, the asuras, the anti-gods, the opponents of the gods, they have come up with this idea of radical renunciation, of leaving society, leaving family behind. And they do this as part of their campaign against the gods. And the idea is, of course, is if the order of the world to which the gods are part is sustained by sacrifice, and you convince enough people not to perform sacrifices, that means they no longer act to sustain the order of the world, then you actually disfavor the gods, and therefore that can be seen as a campaign against the gods, and therefore the asuras, the demons as it's translated here, the anti-gods, are the ones who came up with this idea in the first place. As we look at the end of the passage in the second column, the second paragraph, he cites a couple of passages in support of these views. And then he says, if you look at the second paragraph in the second column, there are innumerable texts that refer to the debts that people incur, such as through offspring, O fire, O Agni, may we obtain immortality. And at his very birth, a Brahman is born with a triple debt, of studentship to the seers, of sacrifice to the gods, and of offspring to the ancestors. Study of the triple Veda, studentship, procreation, faith, austerity, sacrifice, gift-giving. Those who perform these dwell with us. Anyone who praises other things becomes dust and perishes. So it's a strong denunciation of the ascetics by saying that they... they do not wish to repay these debts. One of the debts that, interestingly enough, Vadaina adds here to this is the first quotation that's from the Rig Veda there. Through offspring, O fire, may we obtain immortality. And so that's the idea of, okay, through offspring, but it's also the debt, the sort of some Vedic texts talk about that we have the burden to obtain heaven because the Veda enjoins that we should strive to obtain heaven. And so that's kind of a burden or a debt we're born with as well that we have to repay. And so therefore, anyone who rejects this, anyone who moves away from this is anti-Vedic, is against the teachings of the Vedas, is therefore against the Vedic gods, and does not live a proper life. And if you turn the page, you have another passage there from the Aitareya Brahmana, which, if you remember, the Vedic texts you have the four Vedas, each of them has supplementary texts, the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, and the Upanishads. And so this is from the first of those, the Brahmana, where it says, a debt he pays in him, an immortality he gains, the father who sees the face of his son born and alive. Greater than the delights that earth, fire, and water bring to living beings is a father's delight in his son. By means of sons have fathers ever crossed over the mighty darkness, which is death, for one is born from oneself, a fairy laden with food. What is the use of dirt and deerskin? What profit in beard and austerity? Seek a son, O Brahman. He's the world free of blame. The husband enters the wife. Becoming an embryo, he enters the mother. A wife is called wife because in her he is born again. This is a play on Sanskrit words. One of the words for a wife is jaya, and jan, the verbal root, is said to be derived from jan, the verbal root, which means to be born. And so the wife is called that, because in the wife, the husband is reborn in the form of the son. You're reborn as your son. You sort of continue your life as your son, not literally, obviously, but it's your son is the cause of your immortality, both in the sense that your family name and lineage is continued, but also in the sense that they will continue to make offerings to you when you are in heaven. And so therefore, he says, the text ends there, a sonless man has no world, has no loka, has no world in heaven, and therefore you need to have a son. What use is dirt and deerskin? What profit in beard and austerity? These are the ascetics who say, let's live a simple life. Let's live a life of tapas, of austerity, and generate that ascetic power within us that allows us to attain liberation and freedom from death, not by going to heaven, but by breaking the cycle of rebirth and attaining moksha, attaining liberation, which means attaining Brahman. And that can only be done not through Vedic ritual, but only by contemplation, acts of austerity, acts of tapas that will go there. And so you see, this is the tension that you find in the early texts, where you have a community of ascetics that is developing, and the householder tradition of the Vedic ritualist respond to that by saying, this is all improper. These people have not understood the very fundamentals of Vedic knowledge. They claim to follow the Vedic teachings, and as we've seen, they claim to that Brahman can be known through a study of the Vedas, particularly the Upanishad, but they've missed the very fundamental point, is that if you have no children, you have no world. You have no immortality that you can attain. Now, as time goes on, however, the sort of the asceticism that is found, that sort of grows out of the Upanishads, and it's one of the tough questions is, where does that come from? And there's basically two views. Some argue that it emerges from contact with other cultures further to the east in India, where they are exposed to new ideas, and then gradually this sort of emerges To me, the more plausible, the more convincing argument is the other argument, which is that it emerges actually out of Vedic ritualism, and that you see that the ideas that are there are further developments of ideas found in Vedic texts, found within the performance of Vedic rituals, like the importance of tapas in the brahmachari life, and so on, and that they're developing that further or taking that, interpreting that in a different way than the ritualist and come to these conclusions. It is also in the Vedic texts themselves, like, for example, in the Rig Veda, there is reference to ascetics. And as we have here in the Aitareya Brahmana, which is one of the earliest Vedic texts, you also have reference to ascetics. Do they really see this as a new development, or is this something that's been going on for much longer and has existed alongside Vedic ritual? That's sort of a bigger question that remains unanswered. But as time goes on, what you see happening is that there is more and more of an acceptance of the presence of the renouncers, of the ascetics, within the broader Vedic worldview. And if you have Vadayana, for example, who in his Dharma Shastra, who says that there is only one stage of life, which is the householder. Everything else is of no importance because only householders have children. And a brahmachari obviously does not have children because he has to observe strict celibacy while he's a child himself. And gradually what you see developing, what you find in most Dharma Shastras, is the acceptance that there are four distinct orders or stages of life. And so the first two are these, brahmachari and grihastha, so student life and householder life, to which are then added two more, which you have on the handout, vanaprastha, which literally means sort of a forest dweller, which is a married state of life, but it has some degree of austerity in it, where they live in sort of a reclusive way in the forest or in the wilderness, away from the villages and the cities, and perform Vedic rituals there. And finally, you have, let's put it here, the sannyasa, or the sannyasis, which are the monks, the ascetics, those who have renounced the world and wander around, do not have a fixed abode in most cases, and live off of alms they beg from the householders. And so you do get some later Dharma Shastras, you do get sort of the idea that the householders are the most important ones because they feed all the others. The sannyasis come to them for begging for food. The brahmacharis are supported by them. Therefore, the householders are really the core of it all. But in general, there's an acceptance of that there are these four stages of life. And in the Dharma Shastras, the way it is generally portrayed is that ideally, or the way it comes to be portrayed, is that you go through all of them. So you start as a brahmachari studying the Veda, you get married, you then gradually come to live a more reclusive life until ultimately you renounce the world, you leave your wife and family behind, and you become an ascetic. And the way the Dharma Shastras start to talk about that is, of course, in ritual terms, where they say, what you do in order to become a sannyasi, the problem is, of course, that is the problem that Vadayana identified, that if you become a sannyasi, you're not married, so you cannot perform Vedic rituals because you need to be married to perform Vedic rituals. And this is the difficulty, because ritual is what it's all about. And so the way Dharma Shastras sort of come to see it is that when you become a sannyasi, you ritually end your ritual life. And what you do is you perform your own cremation. You cremate yourself ritually with the fire that is established in your household. And at that point, during the ritual, you breathe in the smoke from the fire. And by doing that, you install Agni. You install that fire on the altar of your heart. And from then on, you have internalized the ritual, and you, through meditation, you can come to perform that Vedic ritual within yourself. It's your whole being becomes an offering, as it were. And from that point on, because you're cremated, you have ritually performed your own cremation, you're dead to society, you have no more claims on inheritance, for example, you have no more relations with your family, and you are also no longer allowed to perform sacrifices. And so the way the Dharma Shastras come to accept it is that, yes, you can go through this if at the end of your life, if you've fulfilled all these debts in your stage of householder life, you can prepare for death by becoming an ascetic, by becoming a sannyasi, and internalizing the ritual. Ascetic traditions that develop have a similar view of this, though they generally don't emphasize the ritual side of it, but they too have their initiation into ascetic life generally involves the performance of your own cremation, where you have a funerary pyre, which you then light, and you say all the mantras that you would say at a funeral, and from that point onwards you're dead, and you have no more place within society. But they do not see this necessarily in those ritual terms, but they see that the debts that the ritualists are concerned about, these debts are concerned with Ritta, with the sustaining of the order, but behind Ritta, as we have seen in Yajnavalkya's teachings, is Brahman, and therefore if you focus on Brahman and you realize you come to know the nature of Brahman, all these debts are automatically paid off, and you do not need to worry about those anymore. And so you have kind of a radical ascetic traditions that move in that direction, that say, we do not need to worry about this, and therefore we also do not need to go through this stage of householder life or vanaprastha of reclusive life. And you can go straight from this to this. And there is no stigma attached to this. This is a proper life that you can live. The ascetics in sort of traditional Hindu society are often portrayed as sort of the lone individuals who break away from society, who wander around from village to village begging for food, for a little food to sustain their lives. And this is kind of the ideal that is portrayed in a lot of texts. You have there a very famous passage from a fairly late text, but still an important one, the Narada Parivrajaka Upanishad, which is a late Upanishad. You have a lot of texts that continue to be written up until actually the 19th century that are given the title Upanishad, as sort of giving them that authority of being Vedic texts. And here you have sort of, this is often cited in ascetic, in texts in ascetic traditions as sort of the ideal of an ascetic life, where he says, seeking perfection, let him wander alone at all times without a companion, for he realizes that a solitary man who neither forsakes nor is forsaken attains perfection. After he is renounced, he should be tranquil, show kindness towards all beings, carry a triple staff and a water pot, rejoice in solitude, and enter a village only in order to beg food. One constitutes a true mendicant. Two, the scriptures say, form a pair. Three are called a village. Anything more, make a city. Let him never form a city or a village or even a pair. An ascetic who forms these three falls from the law, falls from dharma proper to him. And so he falls from the dharma of a sannyasi, of an ascetic. Such people gossip with each other about news of kings, alms, food, and the like. They'll say, oh, go to that village, you can get good food there. Intimacy undoubtedly gives rise to attachment, backbiting, and jealousy. Living alone and without desires, let him never talk with anyone. When he's addressed, let a recluse always merely respond, Narayana, which is a name of God. This is kind of the ideal. Do not form a city, do not form a village, do not form a pair. Live on your own, live this in total solitude. Do not talk to other people. This is the proper life. This is the proper dharma of a sannyasi. And you do have people who do that up until this day. But there is also, as this develops, you get also real ascetic traditions that develop with ascetic institutions and ascetic orders. You have the development of monasteries, of lineages of ascetics into which one is initiated, therefore the importance, some texts stress the importance of living within a community of ascetics who can help you sustain your ascetic practice. It is also that as the ascetic movements develop and grow in prominence and are more and more accepted, they become also the focus, the householders start to look up to them as well, and start to see them as important people worthy of veneration. And with that, of course, comes what you get in this passage, what this passage is criticizing. You get patronage, as he says here, you know, such people who live with other people gossip with each other about news of kings, on foot, and the like. And what develops is that kings would sponsor the development and the establishment of monasteries, and some of these monasteries become very prominent and very powerful indeed, politically as well as culturally and sort of religiously. But they do gain a lot of political power as well. There's one, a monastery in the south of India, in a place called Sringeri, is said to have actually was wealthy enough that it could fund the army of the local kingdom to then go to war. That's the amount of wealth they had and the amount of power they had. In inscriptions, it is said that the abbot of the monastery made it rain gold for an hour, which then he gifted to the king, and the king then built up his army with that and strengthened his kingdom like that. So they become big political powers, and you get texts like these who are criticizing that, who are saying these people have lost the true ideals of ascetic life. They've established institutions, they've established structures that make them that means they become concerned about the news of kings and so on, about patronage they might receive, about alms they might receive, and so on. And so the true ascetic life is only to be lived in total isolation. And of course, the difficulty with this is that if you talk about the history of this, if you have individuals who do this, it means they walk out of history. You never hear from them. And so the ascetics that we do hear of are generally the ascetic institutions that develop, where there are physical structures, there are temples and monasteries that are built, there are inscriptions, there are texts that are produced, and so on. So if you look at sort of the history of asceticism in text and material culture, you get a slightly distorted picture, naturally, because to be a proper ascetic in this sense, as this text here proclaims, is to disappear to anyone, to become irrelevant to everything in the world, and to truly be, as the sannyasi is supposed to be, dead to the world, and have no position in society anymore. We will see, as we continue our exploration to Hinduism, we'll see the emergent, the development of specific ascetic traditions. But this is basically the general backdrop of these traditions. There's a lot of variety within ascetic traditions, as we will see. Some stress the attainment of liberation and stress the importance of realizing the identity of Atman and Brahman in all regards and strive for liberation. Some are more devotional in orientation and build on the theistic Upanishads and see Brahman as a personal god in a theistic sense, and therefore strive to attain union with God, not in the sense of total sort of identity, but rather realizing your dependence on God. And so there's a lot of devotion that comes into this, as we will see later. But anyway, that's kind of the general backdrop to what they're arguing. And that's kind of, you can see the real tension that develops between, within the broader context of Vedic texts, if we consider the Upanishads as Vedic texts, of that conflict between the householder and the sannyasi and the ascetic, that then comes to be resolved through the formulation of the four consecutive ashramas, or orders of life, which are then linked with the four varnas, in the sense not that, you know, these correspond to the four varnas, the four classes of society, but that the varnas themselves have these four stages of life, apart from the Shudras, who only have one stage of life, which is married life. But the twice born, those who are a part of the culture of Vedic learning, the ideal form of life comes to be seen as a gradual progression through these. Whereas, at least in the earliest text, that was more kind of seen as an option. You could sort of pick and choose whichever you liked. So I'll end it there.